Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome, everyone, to Your Cases on Hold. This is episode 61. If you're listening on the day we drop, it's July 2nd for the July 3rd issue of JBJS. Thank you for spending your time with us and hearing about the latest and greatest in orthopedic research. As per usual, for those who are maybe new, we are going to be presenting on articles published in this issue, our thoughts, our own thoughts, our own feelings, what we're saying here are our own takes, not to be considered a policy of the journal or representative of the editor-in-chief, Dr. Bhandari, the other members of the editorial board, the other constituent editors of the journal, or the board of trustees. Your Case on Hold is brought to you by JBJS CME. Check it out for everything that you may need and hopefully get a tailored experience for your educational requirements and lifetime. Like a lifetime of CME in just 1 year. You can get it all, really. Get credit for stuff you're already doing. Get credit for listening to us talk about these articles. And who's talking about the articles? Allow myself to introduce myself, if you will. I'm Andrew Andrew Danger Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor of Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And across the way, I have...
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction.
All right, let's move into it. Okay, so top of the pile, what's up and coming that we have to read about? We have improving how orthopedic journals report research outcomes based on sex and gender by Leopold and colleagues. This is something that everyone should take a look at. It's basically like a white paper that ties into the SAGR guidelines on sex and gender. And I think almost every orthopedic journal editor-in-chief like signed on to this. So you should definitely check it out. That should be permanently free. And it's also going to be appearing in other journals where the editors-in-chief signed on as well. So if you have a subspecialty journal that you subscribe to, you'll probably see it there as well. What's New in Orthopedic Trauma by Chen and colleagues, permanently free. Complications after ankle fracture surgery in Finland between 1998 and 2020. Interesting Clinical Epidemiology by Hakkonen and colleagues, permanently free. Serum and synovial markers in the diagnosis of periprosthetic joint infection of the hip, knee, and shoulder. An algorithmic approach by Tarabici. Life, death, and orthopedic oncology through poetry by Lackman, permanently free. New CMS policy on the mandatory collection of patient-reported outcome measures for total hip and knee arthroplasty. What Orthopedic Surgeons Should Know by Pasqualini. This is something that you brought up on just one of the most recent episodes. So very timely that dovetails nicely with what we've been talking about here at Your Cases on Hold. And then we have the status of the vice chair position in orthopedic surgery departments in 2023 by Goldfarb. I'm interested in that because I am a vice chair. I'd like to know where my future is headed. So definitely I will check that out myself and you all should as well. And then we have, is type 2 diabetes mellitus associated with spinal degenerative disorders? Evidence from observational and two-sample Mendelian randomization analysis by Zhao and colleagues, also with a commentary. Then last, there's an obituary for Newton C. McCullough III, MD, and this is permanently free. With that, we will move into the headlines. In the news this week, my article is Hip Osteoarthritis in Patients Undergoing Surgery for Severe Adult Spinal Deformity, Prevalence and Impact on Spine Surgical Outcomes. So this is by Diego and colleagues. It does come with an infographic. So for visual learners, you will want to have a look at that. So this is a very interesting article. I think more and more, this is kind of at like the crossroads between your discipline and my discipline. We're talking about hip arthritis. And I think we have much greater appreciation that individuals, even when they have a legitimate musculoskeletal orthopedic disorder, they don't exist in a vacuum. There's oftentimes other joints that are affected, joints that are impacted downstream, joints that are impacted with mutual effects. Oftentimes, I will make a diagnosis of hip spine syndrome, and you know, which means that they're contributing factors from the hip and spinal structures. And sometimes it can be hip dominant, sometimes it can be spine dominant, sometimes it can be co-dominant. When it's co-dominant, or even you know, hip dominant and spine dominant, it isn't always a permanent state. Sometimes it may be the hip is more problematic, and sometimes the spine may be the bigger driver. But really, they are playing off of each other. And I think it's important for the patients that we treat that we have a better and broader appreciation of that. And that's kind of what Diego and colleagues are trying to do here. This is work that's conducted under the auspices of the International Spine Study Group and their registry, which is a very productive registry that I have several articles where I'm not on this article, but I am familiar with the registry. It is a clinically robust registry that is collected from a variety of different centers across the U.S. and sometimes with contributors from overseas as well. So, you know, this is the kind of data set that you're going to need to study something like this in a very robust way. And even though they did do their best, as we've discussed before, it never fails that you think you have an absolute waterfall of patients or clinical substrate, and it turns into just a trickle. So, you know, they started with 520 patients with adult spinal deformity. They're looking for these individuals who also have hip arthritis. Severe bilateral hip osteoarthritis was identified in 34% of the population, so just 177 of 520 patients out of that total who were in the registry. So, you know, their first intent was really just to get a sense of the prevalence of this condition in this population. And this is a multi-center contributing group. So there is some case that, you know, this may be the real prevalence in the population, at least being selected for surgery. And that is an important caveat. So we have 1 in 3 patients had severe hip osteoarthritis bilaterally. The statistical approaches, again, they're working with some limitations here. I think they do the best that they can. The real interesting and novel findings of this work, I think, pertain to the size of the sample, the opportunity for some fair amount of clinical variation and heterogeneity within the population, and the case that this could be translational and be a real prevalence finding. But you know, they do some additional testing using linear regression. I'm not sure that that's ideal, because I would expect these outcomes that they're measuring, particularly both radiographic parameters and patient-reported outcome measures, and those in particular, the latter in particular as the main outcome, to be non-parametric, which means that deploying linear regression in that context may not be the ideal approach. But, you know, what they did find was that worse baseline SVA and PROMs that persisted 1 year following the surgery were encountered in patients with severe bilateral hip OA. That is kind of a marker for suboptimal or at risk for lower levels of improvement and higher levels of disability following the surgery. What can you do with that? That part is a little bit harder to deduce. I think it's, you know, kind of make of it what you will. You know, the conclusion says concomitant hip and spine disease are common, remain challenging for joint arthroplasty and spine surgeons. That's kind of a non sequitur. I don't think you didn't need this study to tell you that.
I'm fully on board. But I will say, actually, the hip spine syndrome, while I think hip surgeons knew it and spine surgeons knew it, we didn't actually crosstalk with each other. So that is nice that it's probably the last 5-10 years that has kind of blown up into a more of a robust discussion, you know, with parameters surrounding it as well, too.
Yes, absolutely. And this group has done a lot of work in that space. They had a very nice article a few years ago that was highlighted or selected for web-based longitudinal assessment by the ABOS, where they were looking at the outcomes based on timing. If they have hip and spine problems, do you do the hip first and then the spine? Do you do the spine first, then the hip? And they've had some more recent publications also outlining like kind of the impact that hip osteoarthritis can have. And this is also sort of, I think, follows on from that and is in that lane. So I think there's good information here from a clinical epidemiology standpoint. I think the main caveat is all these patients were still selected to have surgery. So can you make this better? Like, how do you optimize this? Or is it just kind of like, this is something we need to recognize?
I think it's a recognition one.
Engage in the proverbial preoperative decision making and tempering or adjusting expectation management prior to proceeding with the surgery.
Future studies are needed for that.
Maybe randomized trials. Who knows? All right.
Talking about randomized trials.
Here we go.
The next one.
All right. Randomized. We're going to move on to yours. The effects of a abaloparatide on bone mineral density and proximal femoral regions corresponding to arthroplasty Gruen zones, a study of postmenopausal women with osteoporosis. This is by Shet and colleagues, currently free. And there's also a comment. So people don't have to listen to you. They can read somebody else as well.
Thank goodness. So there has been obviously increased interest in bone mineral density recently with the discussion of cemented stems and reducing periprosthetic fracture risk, especially in the setting of total hip arthroplasty. This is from a previous existing study, a randomized phase 3 abaloparatide comparator trial in vertebral endpoints, also known as ACTIVE, which included postmenopausal women with osteoporosis. This drug, abaloparatide, is an osteoanabolic synthetic parathyroid hormone receptor agonist and a candidate agent for bone health optimization by stimulating bone formation with lower increases in bone resorption, resulting in increased bone mineral density at multiple skeletal sites, including the hip. But obviously, with the vertebral endpoints, it was looking at the lumbar spine. Of note, this drug is a promoter of bone formation instead of an anti-resorptive agent. The existing study is a randomized study where they took all these postmenopausal osteoporotic women and randomized to get this abaloparatide, and they also had a placebo group. They also had a group that had a teriparatide as another arm, and this study previously demonstrated increased areal bone mineral density compared with placebo. It also showed reduced risk of vertebral, non-vertebral, clinical, and major osteoporotic fractures compared with placebo. And it also showed that abaloparatide increased cortical volumetric bone mineral density of the trochanter, femoral shaft, and femoral neck compared to teriparatide or placebo. So there's been a lot of studies already done on this cohort of patients. So they did a post hoc analysis because the study was not initially designed for this. Now, what they wanted to do is to see how this drug would affect the bone density in the area specific to total hip arthroplasty, specific the femoral stem, again, in this post-hoc analysis, and included 500 postmenopausal women. So it took a random sampling of 500 postmenopausal women, and they were followed at 0, 6, and 18 months, and they were randomized. Again, they had 250 were abaloparatide, and 250 were placebo. They looked at patients who had hip DEXA scans and underwent 3D modeling versus something called 3D Shaper, followed by virtual resection of the proximal femur and simulated placement of a tapered flat wedge hip stem that guided delineation of the Gruen zones that were fully or largely captured in the scanning region. Zones 1 and 4 were always captured, and 2 and 6 were sometimes captured, but mostly captured in the scanning region. The Gruen zones, if you don't remember them, go back and look at your radiographs. It goes through the zones all the way around the femur itself at different zones of where the bone is. And they placed a specific size taper wedge stem of a certain company into this bone setting and then made conclusions from this. They made comparisons of abaloparatide and placebo groups using change from baselines, and they looked at contrast tests based on missed effect and repeated measure models that adjusted for BMI, age, DEXA scanner model, treatment group, visit, and visit group interaction. So what did they find? They found that prior to treatment, all 3D DEXA parameters in the 4 Gruen zones had similar baseline values in the abaloparatide and placebo groups. They were similar groups, which is good to see as a baseline. Zones 1 and 7 had the highest baseline trabecular volumetric BMD, and zones 2 and 6 had the highest cortical thickness. This is all at baseline. Versus placebo, looking specifically at the abaloparatide group, they had early and progressive increases in integral volumetric bone mineral density treatment in all 4 Gruen zones evaluated, 1, 2, 6, and 7, both at 6 months and at 18 months. Zones 1 and 7, which had the lowest integral volumetric BMD and cortical thickness at baseline, had significant increases in cortical thickness, cortical surface BMD, and trabecular volumetric BMD and 6 and 18 months in the abaloparatide group. So we found that the study found that abaloparatide increased bone mineral density in the proximal femoral regions that interact with and supports femoral stems in total hip arthroplasty. Now, what you have to note, of course, is that this is purely an imaging study, and you're assuming exactly where the implant stands is what you're looking at. And on top of it too, you're also assuming that there won't be any other complications, like during broaching, you could have a fracture, things like that. So there are no clinical data that support this per se. What I'm curious about is why they didn't include a comparison to teriparatide. They have that as part of their study. Maybe it's a smaller group, so maybe that's why they didn't want to compare it, but it would be really nice to see its comparison against another agent. And again, we don't know what actually happened in these patients. So the next study would be future studies. It's to see patients who are undergoing total hip replacements, and if they get randomized to abaloparatide versus placebo, and if that makes a difference in outcomes. But that's obviously a much bigger study and a much bigger enrollment issue there.
Yeah, and also more expensive.
Much more expensive.
I really like this study. I think that, you know, some of these things can be inferred in a logical way, that if you're getting better bone mineral density that interacts with and supports the femoral stem, I think that's going to be a universal good. And if that means less periprosthetic fractures, or again, this is not just treating, it's an ancillary effect in the area where the surgery was done, but it's treating their osteoporosis systemically. This is something that has been done also in the setting of fusion in the spine field. Teriparatide more commonly than abaloparatide in the past, but I think abaloparatide is kind of getting a bigger market share now. I think this is a good use of the of secondary data. It is secondary data. Yes, it would only be level one if you do a randomized trial. I don't know that that's necessary for what they've shown here, I think, pretty conclusively.
Well, it's pretty interesting. I mean, the only thing I would say as a caveat too is, you know, this is looking at a taper wedge cementless stems. The second you add cement to it, this problem mostly goes out the window. That's something to think about. But it is an interesting study and a good use of data, right? They already had the data, they already had analysis. The only thing I would say too, though, in this study, while it is a good use of the data, they did look a lot of the cortical thickness and other things in other studies. They just hadn't looked at it in the orthopedic setting. So it's kind of like a little bit of an addition of something they already had done.
Fair enough. Valid critique. All right. Are you going to have more critiques for us here in the Your Cases on Hold featurette? Patient-reported outcomes following periprosthetic joint infection of the hip and knee, a longitudinal prospective observational study by Manning and colleagues. I thought this study had some very interesting longitudinal outcomes. I have a personal interest in surgical site infections and infections like epidural abscess in the spine. Really limited literature in terms of longer term effects on patients with these types of infections. This study was called the PIANO, Prosthetic Joint Infection in Australia and New Zealand Observational Study. That is a cohort just of prospectively enrolled patients, no randomization, no actual like specific treatments. It was basically however they were treated, they were just enrolled in this longitudinal prospective registry. It is, according to the authors, the largest investigation on functional outcomes in patients with periprosthetic joint infection. They had 741 participants overall, with patient-reported outcome measures available at 12 months for 233 with the hip and 342 with knee periprosthetic joint infections. So really good numbers with a lot of longitudinal follow-up. They're talking primarily at 12 months, but they also have, you know, some data on additional time points. So I think this is very interesting from a natural history, clinical epidemiology standpoint. Good that it's prospective observational data. From my standpoint, those are the main features that really are on the positive side, you know, for this work. They do get into some choppy waters where they start doing logistic regression analyses, making bivariate comparisons, and then using p-value thresholds to include variables and in a multivariable model. And for those listeners who've been, you know, even just listening to 10%, six of our 60 previous episodes, you know, I don't like it when they start talking about stuff like that. Because they may be underpowered for some of their, you know, it's a large sample overall, but when you start making individual comparisons, there may be some limitations. It's much better to do that kind of thing with a conceptual model if you're going to do it. I'm not even sure why it was that necessary. They would have, you know, had you like Jerry Maguire at, we're just going to talk about the natural history of these patients. Where are they at 1 year, 2 years, so many years out from the infection? What are the issues that are really driving inferior outcomes? And if that's done with a conceptual model, it makes more sense, because here's everything that we could consider, the data elements that we captured in this purposefully constructed prospective study. So if you thought everything was important, you should be adjusting for it in the final regression model. And if it wasn't important, then just don't include it in there. It doesn't matter about how this performs or that performs in a bivariate comparison. You know, I think overall, when they get into their predictive factors, I think that, you know, you have to take with a little bit of a grain of salt, because there may be some methodologic artifacts that are driving some of those findings. And I think in any one individual surgeon's practice, they're going to have to think about how these things that these authors are calling out match up with what they've seen in their own experience or in their own patients, because some of these findings may be parochial to the individuals who are contributing patients to this registry. That said, this is something that I really just want to kind of touch base on you or with you philosophically. So they said that you need to consider the PJI type, meaning hip or knee PJI, when evaluating treatment success. Superior functional outcomes are associated with early PJI and with the achievement of a clinical cure. I mean, I think that latter statement goes without saying. The first part really like kind of got to me though, because even in the spine setting, it's a similar problem. Is success in this setting judged by a particular score? I don't think it is. And I think it should be patient specific. It should be patient centered. And it should be adjusted to the context of the patient. And what I mean by that is, if you had a patient who had a PJI and was severely septic, and you know, you had the family come in because they're in the ICU and you're telling them, like, you know, they're on pressors, the blood pressure is volatile, the lactic acid levels are elevated, and they're like, we don't really think that your family member is gonna make it through this hospital stay or tonight. And then after heroic surgical and intensivist measures, they're still here 3 years later, but their knee is stiff and they have a limp. I think you're going to say to them, like, well, you know, I think this is the best kind of outcome that we could have hoped for in that setting, right? It's not, you're not going to be like, well, your PROMS is like kind of a little bit lower than average, so
okay. You're out, no more.
Right?
Like, you suck. It's true. It's not a primary hip or primary knee, and we don't take the baselines into comparison for sure.
So I just thought that was kind of a little, I think they missed the take-home message for this by just being focused on a score, or saying that the score should be considered when defining treatment success. I think treatment success is if they're doing reasonably well and the forgotten joint score is still saying that it's a forgotten joint, that's going to be a win, right? And it just doesn't help when you have these comparisons. Like, if you tell patients, like, if they say I'm not doing well, and you say, well, actually, your PROM score is like better than the average patient. So if they don't feel they're doing well, then they're not going to be doing it. Like, to them, they're not doing well. It doesn't help to show them, oh, well, actually, on your PROM score, you're doing better than average. So
I completely agree with you. I mean, this is such a hard area. And the problem is, you know, I'm a hip and knee surgeon. I get it. We're focused on the numbers. That's all I want to see. We want to see them getting better and things like that. And that's our patient-reported outcome. I mean, this is a good step, right? Because it used to be just like, you know, 90-day readmission, reoperation, that sort of stuff like that. Right now, we're trying to incorporate how patients are doing as part of it. And I think that's what when people ask about the morbidity, not mortality, but the morbidity of these procedures, what it means. But, you know, how relevant is it and how much does the patient care? That's a big question. And yeah, we don't ask that question in these patient-reported outcomes.
And it's not just total joint arthroplasty. I think we've seen a lot of papers. When you start talking about relative outcomes, meaning the patient's outcome as compared to a hypothetical other person that doesn't exist and isn't like involved in, this is their knee. It's not, your knee is so much better than this other person's knee, or your knee is so much worse than this other hypothetical average person's knee. If the person feels like their knee, taking everything into account, is doing well, or they're, you know, they're like, I had an infection and after the infection, you helped save my knee, and I didn't have to have an amputation, and I'm grateful for that. Telling them it's better or worse than something that doesn't exist, I don't think is going to change what their outlook is, right?
No, it really won't. And it won't change your treatment. So they also talk about things like, you know, if you can treat earlier ones, like they do better if they have earlier treatment or DARE and things like that. Like that's clinically based, not a, well, I'm only going to do this treatment because your outcomes will be better.
Right. Yes. No, 100%. Yeah. So there's such a Bayesian phenomenon in that where the ones that were diagnosed later, it wasn't because people just didn't feel like diagnosing them. It's because they were more challenging.
Right. Yeah. And that's a hard one.
That's not a clinically modifiable
risk factor. And if they present it earlier, that's one thing. If they present later, that's another thing, right? So, right.
Yeah, also true. Let's get into the honorable mentions now. I think we're kind of running short on time. We have humeral component version has no effect on outcomes following reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, a prospective double-blinded randomized controlled trial. This is by Viator and colleagues with a visual summary and is permanently free. This is a randomized controlled trial that includes 66 patients with median follow-up of slightly more than 2 years. They found that securing the humeral component at neutral version or 30 degrees of retroversion in the reverse total shoulder arthroplasty resulted in similar active shoulder external rotation, internal rotation, forward elevation, abduction, and strength, complication rates, and VAS pain, as well as promised tendon physical and ASES scores at 2 years. So definitely worth checking out for anyone who's doing reverse total shoulders. And I think there's some, you know, viable take-home messages there for the general orthopedic specialists or shoulder specialists, what have you. Next, we have total intravenous anesthesia with propofol reduces discharge times compared with inhaled general anesthesia in shoulder arthroscopy. This is by Cabaleta and colleagues and is 30 days free. This is also a randomized controlled trial. This considered patients who underwent shoulder arthroscopy performed by a single surgeon in an ASC over recent years. The groups consisted of 42 and 40 patients. And ultimately, this showed that total intravenous anesthesia with propofol has the potential to improve both PACU time and total time until discharge, while reducing antiemetic use, and they encourage its consideration by other orthopedic surgeons. I think this is particularly important for individuals who, like this surgeon here, working in ASCs. So important information there, and potentially also translatable to other surgeries performed in ASCs. And then we have distraction osteogenesis reconstruction following resection of bone sarcomas, surgical, functional, and oncologic outcomes from a prospective trial analysis by Botso and colleagues. This is a very interesting study that, you know, discusses rare sarcomas of the bone and with osteogenesis reconstruction and looks at a variety of outcomes from a clinical epidemiology standpoint. So for those in the oncology space, those interested in outcomes, I think this could be selected for oncology-specific web-based longitudinal assessment questions. Definitely worth checking out going forward. That's about all the time that we have currently. We've come to the end of our time together. Went by fast. We kind of ran out. We'll try to do better next time. If you like what you heard, like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. Check out our back issues. Listen again in 2 weeks for what's up next in the middle of July. If you did like what you heard, maybe come back and give us another try. But hopefully your case is ready to go. But here we're still on out.